We are Vineyard.
Somos Viña.
We are Vineyard.
I think there were a couple of things that I remember, like, okay, this might work. That day that I was prayer walking and I was crying and thinking I need to quit, I went and just happened to wander into my favorite lunch spot in our neighborhood. And a young woman who waited on me said, hey, you know, what are you doing here? Just starting up conversation. And said, you probably don't care. She's not a Christian. I'm just like, why am I even sharing this? But I'm in one of those days. And I said, I'm planting a church and really want to be this kind of church. And I'm sort of describing, you know, you have that like pitch that you do as a planter.
Totally.
You know?
Working on this. Yeah.
And she's like, wow. She goes, I don't go to church, but if I did go to church, that's the kind of church I would want to go to. She said, I just feel compelled to tell you, you should keep going.
Wow.
And again, at this point, I'm coming from a Baptist cessationist. Totally. I'm not even a charismatic at this point. I'm like, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And I was like, the Lord's like, I see you.
Totally.
And I've got people here. It's like that Acts moment where it's like, I've got people in the city. Don't leave.
Welcome to the We Are Vineyard podcast. Conversations to help us grow with Jesus and each other. This season, we have a number of incredible guests lined up for you. And we're excited to let you know that this season's episodes will also be available as videos. So subscribe on YouTube so you never miss an episode. On today's episode, Jay talks with Brandon Shields. Brandon is the director of church formation at Practicing the Way. Let's listen in.
Well, we're here in LA, and we've been here at a meeting you helped curate. What is this thing? Because we're finishing it up right now.
Yeah, this is our annual pastor conference. So each year we host about 600 or 700 of our pastor friends from around the world who come together to learn about what it looks like to bring spiritual formation into their churches.
And it's been four?
This is our fourth.
Four.
Yeah.
Okay. 4 years. This is my first coming to. And you're pulling people, you said 600 or 700 from around the world. How do people find what you're doing? Why do humans appear?
Yeah, I think probably mostly through John Mark's writing and teaching.
Yep.
So a lot of people have come to Practicing the Way through maybe reading the Practicing the Way book or our resources. We have a whole ecosystem of resources, practices that churches can implement. So typically a small group leader might run this solitude practice. Mm. We have 9 spiritual practices that form what we just call like a rule of life for the modern era.
Yep.
And so maybe a small group leader, a staff member, a pastor read the book and then took some their staff or a small group through the course. And then they find out, oh, there's a gathering.
There's more of this. Yeah,
well, you know what it is? There's so much isolation and loneliness in the work. So many pastors in different traditions. And we have literally almost every denomination, non-denomination, whatever we're doing, not post-denomination.
Totally.
Represented. But, you know, it's like me. I was a pastor in Indianapolis, Indiana. Yeah. Mm. I didn't know anybody else that was thinking about spiritual formation in their church. Mm-hmm. And so I remember for the first time really learning about John Mark and going, wow, there's somebody who's speaking my language.
Yeah.
And then the first pastor conference, I literally remember just flying out there. It was my first week on the job for Practicing the Way. But even as a pastor, flying out there, being in a room with 700 other pastors. And it was an emotional experience because I was like, wow, I'm not. It was like that C.S. Lewis moment where he's like, you too, you know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And so most of them will hear about us through the resources and then in some ways probably risk coming out by themselves or maybe with one of their staff members.
Yeah, bring a team member. Right?
And then the next year they'll come and they'll bring their elders and other people who they want to set a, you know, really these conferences were trying to spark pastoral imagination for helping them just explore the way that they think about ministry and expanding that a little bit. And so I think for them, they come and they get a little bit of a taste of that and then want to bring others along.
That's good. Okay. So we know you're a pastor in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
Let's start all the way back. Let's hear kind of your story, how you get there.
Yeah.
Tell me about where you were born and grew up. Let's start there.
Yeah, so I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh.
Yeah, so I'm a Buckeye.
All right.
But not very long, 2 years. So, you know, pretty illegitimate.
We'll still keep you.
Yeah. My mom's from Southeast Ohio. My dad's from Northern Kentucky.
Mm.
And so when I was 2, they moved to Louisville. And that's really where kind of home is for me. So Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay.
Home of the Kentucky Derby. Most people know about the Kentucky Derby. And then, my wife also grew up there. So I didn't grow up in the church. So my parents were sort of mainline, nominal, you know, religious people.
Some Christmas, I think my Easter,
Methodist and Presbyterian, but nothing meaningful. I don't have any meaningful memories of church
right
until I was 13. And so when I was a probably elementary age, my mom started teaching at a religious school. And through that, a kid invited me. I was going to school there and did not know Jesus at a very fundamentalist sort of Southern Baptist church and school. It was a church school kind of thing. So a friend invited me to come to church, and that they used to do like Sunday night visitation where they would just come and show up unannounced at your house and share the gospel. And so that I visited church that night. They came, I was 13, and they shared a version of the gospel with us, sort of that four spiritual laws kind of thing. Yep. And that's how my whole family, actually, my parents were in their 40s.
Everybody,
yes, my whole family trusted Christ when I was 13. My sister was 9 and I was 13. And then we, the next week, got baptized. And it was like literally just a 180. I mean, from we don't go to church to now
this
we're going to church.
What we do.
Yeah. And so it was a pretty significant trajectory shifting event for us.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I started going to church there.
Yeah.
Got involved with the youth group.
Okay.
And like I said, I was at this Christian school. Mm-hmm. And really through my teenage years, I would say I was a very struggling new Christian. And my family got really active and really changed. My parents both came from massive addiction, alcohol addiction. Mm. Grandfathers were in the war. Mm. Just so much pain and wounding and unresolved stuff. And so I think for us, it was great. I mean, all of a sudden people are teaching my parents like how to stay married,
how to be humans,
good humans, but it was so different. I remember my dad like sitting down with me starting to study the Bible with me. And I was like, this is so strange.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was very, confusing, you know?
And so like, what kind of kid were you? Were you like sports kid, academic kid?
Oh, both sports kid. Sports and academics. Yeah.
Really? Wow. Okay.
So I was the smart kid who also played sports or trying to be smart kid also played sports.
Yeah. Yeah. What'd you play?
I played basketball and pretty much every sport, basketball, baseball, golf were my primary. And then I played 1 year of college basketball at a very small NAIA school in Louisville. So I was a mediocre athlete who got a academic scholarship to play at a Catholic college, which was like a lifelong dream.
Yeah, you know, that's pretty cool.
And so, and then ended up, I was there for a year and then went to college at the University of Kentucky.
Oh,
and did 3 years. I did not play basketball there.
No,
they were national champions by that point. You
that'd
know?
Be hard. And so when you graduate high school and you're going to go play ball at this little school, what do you think you're going to do? You're thinking, I'm going to be a pastor. I think I'll be a lawyer. No, I think I'll be in business. What was in your head?
I was thinking business at that point.
Really?
So I really wanted to be an entrepreneur. So I went to college, went to business school, got a degree in marketing.
Oh.
I was hoping to just start a business or be a part of a startup. That was kind of, to me, my dad was in sales.
Okay.
So. And my mom was a teacher. And so I knew I didn't want to be a teacher because they didn't make very good money.
Totally.
And it was very hard on my mom. And so I thought, man, it'd be great to basically start a business and try to make as much money as I could. At that time, I was still very, I would say just very secular in the way that I was thinking about my life.
Sure.
You know, like I had become a Christian at 13, but it really didn't have very much bearing on the way that I looked at the world.
And so when you're in college doing all this stuff, is faith still, I mean, are you trying to go to some church or, crusade or I'm trying to think what a good Baptist would go to? They're probably Baptist Student Union. Uh-huh. Or, are you doing all that stuff? Are you like, nah, I've had enough.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm an oldest child, so I had a high conscientiousness and I was trying to always give the appearance of doing the right thing.
Sure.
So I was still going to church.
Okay.
I was involved with, you know, some adjacent religious organizations, but sophomore year, I went on a mission trip to the Philippines and had this massive spiritual awakening.
Wow.
So I went with, some people know Tim Tebow, his dad was a missionary to the Philippines, and he used to lead Baptist youth groups on these missionary trips. And so we went with a big group of like 50 or 60 college students with the Tebows.
Wow.
And while I was there, it was the first time in my life that I had encountered really serious Christians, like really thoughtful, serious Christians. And I was like, I don't have that. Even though I consider myself a Christian.
Yeah,
this is a different level
of
Christianity. And I think for me, I was drawn to that, and it was a sort of a wake-up call. And then I remember meeting these Filipino pastors who were just legit, authentic, deep souls. I mean, they've been shaped through so much suffering. They were all like co-vocational they loved Jesus and they were so humble and kind. Wow. And I just remember that being so my earliest experience with Christianity at 13, this church where I became a Christian, was really just a kind of a toxic, abusive environment. The pastor that led us to Christ ended up having affairs in the church. And then the principal at the school had, you know, done some things just with, there was some abuse there with children and ended up going to prison.
Oh my God.
So for me, like our earliest experiences were very much like, wow, if this is Christianity, I don't know that I want to have anything to do with this long-term, you know? And I think it took some time for me to then kind of come to this place where all of a sudden I'm realizing like, oh, there's a different way to embody this. And so that trip combined with a couple other things that really happened my sophomore year, all of a sudden, and then transferring to University of Kentucky, I'm in this community with really what I think of as God was, there was just renewal happening. So it's right down the road from Asbury University. Some of you guys maybe know the Asbury Outpouring. And there's just something that God's doing and stirring in these college students. And so I come to Lexington and all of a sudden I'm in this community of people who are all experiencing an awakening together. And so all of a sudden now I'm going to Fellowship of Christian Athletes. I'm going to church because I want to, not because I have to. And there was a real turning point for me of just living Christian community authentically with other hungry disciples of Jesus who are all my age. And I thought, wow, this is what I want, you know? And so,
it's interesting you say that. I've had one thought this whole week when I've been here that I was thinking, I'd like to talk to John Mark about this sometime. And you now, I mean, there is something, at least in my experience, just doing discipleship stuff as a pastor, there's something that happens when you take people overseas out of a context, especially with the poor. That is so jarring. That even if they have a pretty vital life with God, they just see the world differently. There's something about the global communion of the church that is disorienting in a way that something awakens. And almost anyone I've ever taken overseas, so much so that, you know, we really fiddled with like, is there, maybe there's not a great way to like continually disciple people just in the US. Like you got to get them to see this stuff. Well, just because the water is so stacked with entitlement and consumerism and individuality and materialism and all this stuff that the minute somebody is in like a pastor in Central Africa's home or attending a thing in Southeast Asia or in a church in Brazil, they're like, wait a minute, this doesn't resemble my faith.
Totally.
And which one of these things doesn't line up? And it's obvious if you open the Bible, which one's off. So that's really interesting. And I'm amazed at how many people match your story. You know, like I was doing fine. You know, I love God, and but something shifted when I got in a different context. I've been thinking about that this whole week. I wonder where in a formation journey does disorientation become essential? And, but so
it's so disruptive. I mean, and it really, really is. I agree with you. Like, you know, when I was jumping into ministry at that time, there was a lot of research coming out about sort of the ineffectiveness of short-term missions. And again, there's a whole history that we all all know about.
And they're not wrong.
Right. But the impact, what was also being shown was the impact that it had on the people that were on the trip in terms of this wilderness.
It's a discipleship thing.
Yeah, 100%.
It's not. You're doing any, you don't do anything for them. I mean, I'm sure you did great in the
Philippines. No, we did not. I'm sure we did more harm than good. But I mean, it really became a paradigm because then I went back again the next summer and I lived in Morocco for the summer.
See, there you
for
go.
For 6 weeks.
Wow.
With, I mean, I'm staying in Muslim homes. What's that?
We're in Morocco.
We stayed all over the desert. I mean, this is right before 9/11. The country had been closed and the king of Morocco allowed us to come. And again, it was like with a sort of like an undercover mission, you know, thing. But it was like out in the desert, Fez and Oujda and Berkan, these small little towns right before 9/11. I mean, up in the hills in the mountains where Al-Qaeda's training as a 20-year-old. But it was amazing in terms of like the conversations we were having and what it sort of awakened in me evangelistically, missionally, and other things. then Puerto Rico, and then Guatemala, wow. and then all these places. And I began to then take others with me on these trips. Wow. And it was so formative for me. That's a friend of mine who is one of our elders at the church we planted, he was a missionary in Argentina with his mm-hmm. wife for many years. Mm. And he said, you know, when we would have teams come from the States, they would want to come and like do all the stuff for us. And he said, I realized like what it was actually transformative for them to come. Mm-hmm. But what I would tell them is come and just walk and pray and yeah. just be present.
Yeah, be in our church, right.
Because totally. That's what we actually need from you. We yes. need spiritual cover. Yes. We need you befriending the people that we're serving.
Yes.
But inevitably, they would go back very different just by coming and engaging in those simple things.
Yeah,
and so I agree 100%.
Yeah. Okay. So you have all these little trips. So it seems you're not doing all that if you're not thinking about ministry at some
yeah,
point.
Right.
So something's starting to turn where you're yeah. going. Are you thinking you'll be a missionary? Are you yeah. thinking, that's what it sounds yeah. like. Yeah.
So I came back from Philippines. Like I'm going to be a missionary. I'm wow. going to go and live overseas. And this is what I want to do with my life. And so I'm wow. at Enneagram 3. So give me a task to Let's achieve. Win. I'm going to go all
right,
in
right.
to the extreme.
Yeah.
But it did. I mean, immediately I came back. Mm. I finished undergrad in business, started going to seminary, came back and started to serve at the church that I was at. And I really thought my wife and I started dating that going overseas, either short term or long term, could be in our future. And so we kind of were pursuing that for a season, and then got pregnant with our first kid, started pastoring a local church, and actually as a youth pastor and then a college pastor and teaching pastor. And I thought, man, I can still do this. I can express this missional calling in my church and help influence and shape Americans as they're thinking about doing some of that work. So
in Louisville?
We were in Louisville for 7 years at a church. Actually, the church where I became a Christian that had been so toxic had new leadership and had experienced some changes. And so we actually came back there and I got to serve there for a season.
Huh.
And then my youth pastor moved to South Florida near Miami, West Palm Beach. And so he asked us to come down there. It was sort of a church revitalization. Mm. And he's like, I don't know if I'll be here. I don't know if they'll fire me in 2 years, but let's go do this. And so we're like, why not pastor at the beach?
Yeah. You
know, so we're
pretty cool place.
It's great. Yeah, great place to do ministry. Yeah. And so we ended up down there for 2 years. And it was while we were there that we really felt this call to church planting. Mm. So that was sort of the beginning of
getting to Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So why Indianapolis?
That's a great question.
I mean, it's great. Don't get me wrong. It's a nice place.
Not the first place that comes to most people's minds when they think about.
Well, when you're in West Palm Beach.
Yeah.
Especially.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very long, as it tends to be, painful story of how we left the church and some of the relational things that we experienced as a result of the call we felt to go plant a church. But long story short, I was like, let's go to the biggest urban center and let's make an impact.
New York.
I'm like, I'm drinking the Tim Keller Kool-Aid. Yeah. Go to New York City. Let's go to LA. Let's
Mexico
go to
Mexico City.
Yes. Right, and my wife's like, that sounds terrible. Please, let's
or
not do that. Can we
Indianapolis.
Not? Yeah. Or and for her even, like, she was thinking like Nashville, Birmingham, somewhere in the South.
Yeah, yeah.
We're Southerners.
Totally,
you know.
Yeah.
So Indianapolis was like this interesting place where our denomination was really wanting to plant churches in these, what they called the strategic cities. Indianapolis was a place where historically the Southern Baptists had not done a lot of church planting and not successfully. And so they essentially were like, hey, would you guys consider somewhere in the Midwest, like Cleveland or, you know, Chicago or Indianapolis? And so it's like the most strategic is that intersection of what's the most strategic place we could go for the gospel in terms of urban context and a place where my wife wants to live that could be sustainable and is within a few hours of where we grew up. And so Indianapolis is an interesting place because it's 2 million people. Mm-hmm. I think at the time it was like the 13th largest city in the country. And there had not really been a lot of church planting. And so it's a historically mainline Protestant Catholic context. You had a lot of young people, and this is 2011, moving back to the city. Mm-hmm. And there's basically two options for church, super progressive or some of these like evangelical churches that had been were in the suburbs. There's really not a lot going on in the city outside of historically like the Catholic church is there, historic Black Protestant, you know, churches. But so we were like, man, Indianapolis is a really interesting place that has a history of being a very religious city, but seems like Jesus is up to something here.
There's a gap here.
Yeah, there's a gap. And specifically for us at that time, we were like, we really want to plant sort of a Keller-esque gospel-centered missional church. That was sort of That's our short way of talking about it.
So, yeah.
So yeah, we packed up our four kids, five, four, two, and we had just adopted a baby.
Wow.
And again, I did not do this very well in terms of handling this transition. Some of it was out of my control. But we packed up the kids and moved to Indianapolis to a city.
We had no team.
We parachuted in.
We just showed up.
Did you have
mutual relationships around?
Like, no, we knew nobody. That was the time. Do you remember this time in Facebook where you could search what friends you knew in certain cities?
Yeah.
I did the search of Facebook. There was one. We had one contact in Indianapolis.
In common.
It was my nurse from high school. And she lived like 30 minutes outside the city.
And you're like, hey.
No, I did. When we flew in the first time, I reached out to her and she had us over for dinner. She's like,
what are you doing?
Oh, that's cute. I don't know what you guys are doing. We're never doing this again.
Wow.
And so we literally called all of our friends.
Wow.
And we said, we're moving to Indianapolis. Would you consider moving with us? I was almost, I think out of 50, it was like 48 no's. And then one kid from my youth group who had been mentoring for 10 years.
He said,
when the moment you called and you asked me, I went home. He's working at Energy. His wife is a teacher in Louisville. And he said, I told my wife, crap, I think we should go. I think God's telling us to go.
So this is not the crack team you imagined?
No. Oh, no way. No way. I mean, I had in my mind like the Avengers. We're assembling the Avengers and we're all going to India.
And the Lord will obviously, you know, just bring them by droves.
Yeah. So literally two couples said yes. And then our sending church, Summit Church in North Carolina, sent some college students. And I think it was like maybe five college students and then a few couples. And so it was about 15 of us all together the first time we met at our house on a Sunday night.
And so you just did old school church plan.
100%. We literally prayer.
Small group.
And not, even before that, we prayer walked.
Just walk around.
Try to meet people. I mean, I remember the first time going to the grocery store. We knew nobody. And my wife said, somebody looked at me and they spoke to me. And I said, did you get their number? And she goes, no, that would
be
weird.
Did you invite them?
No, I said, get back in there and go get their phone number.
This is all we can do right now. Yeah.
And we would sit at Chick-fil-A for hours because we had free childcare with the Playland. And we would just try to strike up conversations. We went door to door and we knocked on doors. And I mean, I remember like a core team, somebody who jumped into our core team who was like, I'm not even sure they were a Christian. I mean, we were the bad news bears of church planting.
Totally.
You know?
Oh, no, man. I know this.
And this guy was like, this is the dumbest.
Yeah, what are we doing?
What are we doing?
Yeah. We should build a rocket ship and fly to the moon. We have better odds.
Right.
No, I remember when we were, because ours was very similar. We just had a bunch of friends.
Yeah.
We don't know anybody. And I remember literally thinking that. Sitting in a coffee shop, you know, we got our little crew. I remember thinking, I think it would be easier to fly to the moon than do whatever we're doing right now.
Yeah.
Like, how's this going to happen? Yeah. This is not going to happen.
No.
Like, nobody's going to. We were meeting this house. I mean, we look like a cult. Like, 100%. What is this?
100%.
Like, this is not going to work.
Yeah.
Those are pretty weird days.
Oh, I mean.
Because you show up with expectations. To the ceiling.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'd only been in mega churches my whole life. I'd never been in a house church. I had never, I mean,
yeah, me too.
I had no imagination for what we were doing.
Very similar story. Yeah.
And I remember just how weird it was. I mean, we had no categories for this like organic thing in the house. My wife's watching the kids. It's chaos. It's not fun.
Who's going to come?
I mean, I remember having like one of our little small group meetings on Sunday night where we're trying to train the launch team. And this woman shows up. I'd preached at a church that morning and said, hey, anybody that wants to come?
Yeah,
we're
going
to
try this thing.
And so this woman comes like in her 40s. And I thought the night went pretty well.
Yeah, she looks around.
My wife and I are laying in bed that night. I'm like, how'd it go? You know, the women broke up. The guys broke up. Right. And she's like, well, a woman told me that she's plotting a homicide. And she just confessed it to the group. She was dating. She's like in her 40s, like our age.
This is our launch team.
She's dating a 20-year-old and she's plotting a homicide of her husband.
Yeah.
And we were like, cool. Welcome to church planting.
Great.
And then like, I remember passing out, we went door to door, passed out 5,000 flyers to invite people to a movie night.
This one thing. Here we go.
Nobody shows up.
Literally no one.
Zero.
Yeah. I've been in more than one of these.
I mean, I remember it kind of at the end of that season, I literally was walking the neighborhood weeping. I was crying and I was like, God, I have made a major mistake.
Yeah, I was somebody a minute ago.
Right. and nobody cares that I'm here.
Yeah,
you know,
nobody.
Nobody knows.
And if I go back, they may have already forgotten about me. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and but it, you know, so crazy.
We should end the podcast right here. This is.
Don't do it. Don't ever do it. Don't plant a church, or at least not the way we do it. Dude, I can see why people did the launch large thing.
Because all of a sudden,
That feels a lot. Maybe initially a lot more successful.
It sure does.
But I think for us, that slower work of like a more incarnational, loving and listening and learning. Yeah. And we called that first year like year zero.
Yeah, totally.
We want to come and that's just learn the city, to the city.
We have very similar stories. Yeah.
But it did not translate into success.
Well, because people ask you, when did you plant the church? And I'm always like, well, depends on what you mean. What do you think you're asking me?
When do we have our first service?
Exactly. I know. When did I not work like four other jobs? Like what counts?
Yeah.
Because if you count when we moved there, there was nothing that resembled a church.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, like, what do you think? Like, what do you mean? And they're like, I don't know. When did you move? I'm like,
well, people would say, when are you launching the church? And I was like, we have nothing to launch.
What do you mean?
I mean, like, we have nothing. We have no people. We have nothing.
Yes. How would we do that?
Yeah. What would we launch? Who would we launch? Like, we're meeting a bunch of people. And
there's no
strategy.
No.
And for us, at least, we weren't going to come. I knew how to do strategic megachurch where make stuff happen. And I think for us, we were probably in some ways overreacting to that, but we're like, let's just let stuff happen
and
let's
see what happens. God will just help us somehow. And then it's not happening.
Yeah.
So when did you feel like, oh, we're actually doing something? Yeah. Like God has given us favor. Yeah. What was a key turning point?
Yeah. I think there were a couple of things that I remember like, okay, this might work. Mm. That day that I was prayer walking and I was crying and thinking I need to quit, I went and just happened to wander into my favorite lunch spot in our neighborhood. And a young woman who waited on me said, hey, you know, what are you doing here? Just starting up a conversation. And I said, you probably don't care. She's not a Christian. I'm just like, why am I even sharing this? But I'm in one of those days. And I said, I'm planting a church and really want to be this kind of church. And I'm sort of describing, you know, you have that like pitch that you do as a planter.
Totally.
You're
working on this. Yeah.
And she's like, wow. She goes, I don't go to church. But if I did go to church, that's the kind of church I would want to go to. She said, I just feel compelled to tell you, you should keep going.
Wow.
And again, at this point, I'm coming from a Baptist cessationist. Dude, I'm not even a charismatic at this point. I'm like, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And I was like, the Lord's like, I see you.
Totally.
And I've got people here. It's like that Acts moment where it's like, got people in the city. Don't leave.
Wow.
You know, and then the other time was, we were doing a national community model. Mm-hmm. And so I'd been coaching sports teams and we had just been really developing relationships. Yep. I think it was Hugh Halter who said something like, it's not, do you know people's names, but do people know your name?
Yep.
It's like one of the core metrics. Can you just make 50 friends who know your name and who would come to you if they had a problem?
They need help.
You know? And so we had been doing all this work and we threw our first big like missional party at our house. And I'll never forget people showing up and we had like 70 people show up at the house and we had food and we had Christians and about half the group was Christian, half the group was non-Christian.
People hanging out.
And I remember a guy named Derek who had like grown up in the church. He was like the quintessential Indiana religious kid, went to a Church of God college, got kicked out for drinking, swore off the church.
Yep.
And he's there with his family.
Now he's here.
His kids are there.
He's
Rob,
like,
this banker that we had been developing a relationship. He's there with his kids.
Wow.
And all of a sudden it's like, this is a real thing. We don't have a church, we have a community.
Yeah, it's life-giving.
And I think for us, like it was those little moments that we lived on.
Yes.
And that became the nucleus of what continued to grow and multiply. And there's like so many moments like that that were unexpected and surprising where like when we had sort of given up and just were feeling like this is over, God just continued to like give us those little, and I think so much of it was just reframing our metrics of what we thought of as success.
Yes.
It was like these relationships, these opportunities to see people woven into the fabric of community around simple things like meals. I mean, we would literally grew the church through meals just around our dinner table. We used to say the city's not going to change until our dinner tables change. It's sort of like our rally cry.
That's good.
And I had never experienced anything like that. Yeah. And it was so invigorating for somebody who had just basically been doing platform ministry and been a community organizer for mm-hmm. 10 or 15 years, you know.
Well, and it's difficult, if not impossible, to estimate what it takes for an OS to change inside of a leader.
Oh, my gosh.
You think you know what that might be.
Yeah.
Or sometimes you don't even know the OS needs to change. Like,
yeah,
this thing I do on Sundays, that'll probably work in another place. If I just sort of show up.
Yeah.
But then there's all these gaps. Like, well, first of all, there's no stage. There's no people. There's no nothing. I don't even know how I would, how do I even use any of these tools that I have?
Yes.
They're like not useful for whatever I'm doing. Okay. That's cool. We're about missional community. Well, you don't even know what that means until you're like walking around your neighborhood going, I don't even know how to like talk to humans. I'm not even from here.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yes.
How would I even talk to a person, let alone build a world where people would hang out with me? That process is slow.
Yeah.
And it's slow inside the leader.
Oh, 100%.
I mean, not just about, you can't go to enough trainings.
Yeah.
Something has to happen inside of you where you just become a different kind of leader.
Yeah.
Which is so inspiring.
What if the communities you're building could only be as healthy as you are? Better Together is back, and this year we're going deeper. Join Vineyard USA Associations July 21st through 23rd at North Jersey Vineyard for a transformational gathering where beloved community meets emotionally healthy leadership. Featuring Drew Hyun from Emotionally Healthy Discipleship, you'll discover how to lead from wholeness instead of woundedness and build communities where people don't just attend, they truly belong. This isn't just another conference. It's a reset for your soul and a vision for the community God's called you to lead. Early bird pricing is available through May 4th. So don't wait. Learn more and register today at bettertogether.vineyardusa.org. We'll see you there.